Good evening, if you're still watching. Welcome to this Wednesday webcast with me, Scott Castanrennie, the technician. Well, I say that loosely.
Yeah, bumbling fool, half-wit Al Coates, yeah. Me.
Yes. And tonight we are joined by Yoni Iju, if I've said that right, hopefully. Yeah.
It was close.
Yep. And Keely Crawl. Good evening to you both.
Hi.
And thank you for joining us. Now, you are live to probably not very many people, but, you know, welcome.
Thanks for coming along. That's terrible. That's rubbish.
No, because, like, you know, you never know. I can't see who's watching this, because we're doing this on one of the platforms, but you don't know who's watching elsewhere. But, you know, if people are watching, welcome. Thank you.
That's true.
So as we've got two guests on, it'd be best to just crack on and introduce yourself. So Yoni, do you want to go first and introduce yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Yoni Ijo, if you pointed out. I've got a number of different hats. I'm professionally a social worker, working as a social worker for over 30 years. And I'm also an adopter. I adopted with my civil partner two girls who are now 20 and 18. And I was also born in a transracial adoption. I was placed in transracial adoption at the age of 18 months. So I've got all of that experience, and I work as an adoption coach.
Lots in there to, we could be here all night.
That's a remarkable set of things, isn't it? Because often, you know, people say, you're an adopter and a social worker, but you kind of, your experience, you've literally sat everywhere. You know, it's certainly
made me a better each aspect, I think, it's made me a better social worker. Whether it's made me a better mum, I'm not quite sure. We can debate that.
Other opinions are available, perhaps.
Yeah.
Depending on the day of the week, and the moon and the tides and things like that.
I'm
Keely, and I'm a biological mum of two. I'm down the other end of the scale. My children are really small, 2 and 5, and I've worked as a child therapist for just over 14 years, and a lot of that work has actually been with children who have been at risk of being removed from home, or they're in kinship care, or they're in foster placements, or they've been placed with an adoptive family.
Fab. So perhaps one of you can explain why you're here, because we know why you're here, but why are we doing a Wednesday webcast with Yoni and Geely?
Good question.
I think if I start, I'm started running an organization, a company, because I, with all of those different aspects of my experience, I very much felt when I started the adoption journey that I didn't have the level of expertise and skills and training that I, with hindsight, would have wished I'd had. And I don't think people had conversations with me about trauma, about the impacts of trauma, about how I could build sort of strong relationships with the children who came into our family. So when I was introduced to Keely, we talked a lot about sort of how we thought that things could be better. So out of those conversations, we have developed courses and information about what I wish, what I wish I'd known with the expertise that I now have and that Keely has. Mm-hmm. Keely, do you want to add?
I think what we kind of picked up on was that kind of not, I think sometimes often when children come into a family and they've had very kind of difficult experiences in their early years, sometimes things are presented very complex, and everything's there's lots of different professionals kind of intervening with like very complex kind of strategies, and it kind of takes away from just the building of the relationship and having that sense of family life. And I think what Yoni and I have done is really just kind of looked at the simple things that can be done that, you know, aren't all about like having special charts and remembering to do a certain thing at a certain time, just simplifying things, but also just really helping to create good bonds and attachments between parents and children, you know, just to help the children feel safe and a big part of a family. And so we've just, you know, what we've done is just made courses that, you know, that people are responding really well to, and there's quite a few aha moments in there, and it's like, gosh, yeah, all I needed to do was just this small thing. You know, it didn't have to be like grand gestures all the time. Sometimes it's just the small things, the simple things that make the most difference, and that's what Yoni and I have done in our coming together.
I reflect sort of on my own experience, and obviously we as a family, we adopted once, and then, you know, kind of a bit wonky after that, how little children had sort of arrived. But I'm also part of groups of that include prospective adopters and new adopters, and it seems like it just seems really complicated and really, and like you say, that there's really difficult concepts, and there's huge levels of anxiety in parents as well. You know, they've kind of gone through introductions, the pressure's on, the focus and laser beam focus is on them, and then they've got these complicated how they need to introduce a children or develop relationships. So is that sort of informed part of it, that you want to just kind of strip it back?
Yeah, it's about, I think, you know, and so many of like the prospective adopters we've spoken to, you know, they've been reading all the books, you know, yeah, about attachment, and, you know, and they can be really helpful, and I would definitely say, you know, read it, but I think, you know, there's maybe like almost like an information overload, isn't there? And it's all like in theory, isn't it? And what we're trying to do then is kind of distill some of that information down and say, and this is how you could do it in practice. You know, and I think quite a lot of people are overwhelmed, and they think, you know, God, I've got to be like doing like amazing arts and crafts activities every day with my children, and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And we're just really trying to kind of distill that down into something. You know, it has to be manageable, you know, it's... Because we're all busy having children and working and juggling all the other parts of our lives that we do. So we're trying to bring techniques and ideas that just, you know, really just make life easier, but are really helping to strengthen those bonds between parents and children and help the children feel better about themselves.
Mm. And I was going to ask, I mean, you know, you've said distilling kind of lots of different things. Are you using any particular approaches or any kind of, you know, techniques, methods that, you know, we know work? Is it a kind of crossover of them all, or is it kind of picking the best bit? Or, you know, how does that work?
I mean, I think a lot of my work as a child therapist is based in play. So there's, you know, in the webinars that we do and in the training, you know, there's a lot there about how play can be useful to kind of help build relationships, but we're also looking at like gentle parenting techniques as well that really help to kind of build the relationship too, and that kind of combination together, mm-hmm. you know, being a gentle parent and using, like, you know, it's not like a special technique we've like created ourselves, you know, it's things like being consistent, using active listening, being playful, you know, using child-led play, you know, they're the things, you know, that we're kind of like talking about and kind of really expanding on and encouraging people to use in an everyday situation.
Yeah, a big proportion of the conversations that we've had through courses with carers is almost demystifying and recognizing that they don't have to be, they are parents first and foremost, not therapists and psychologists. Yeah. And there's a real temptation for social workers and the professionals around a child to sort of over expect them to be able to be a parent and a teacher and a therapist and everything else around the child, but actually sometimes that, well, a lot of the time that's not what the child needs. What the child actually needs is one-to-one support and time in a very child-led way. And I think, you know, one of the things with hindsight that I wish I'd known is how powerful that is, just actually sitting with the child and allowing the child to steer what your activity is. And I think it's something that we don't, as adults, do. We get very embroiled in the busy day-to-day of life. And if you scope out that time, then it does pay dividends, I think, on building those relationships and making that safe space for children to actually talk about their experiences and work through some of their trauma, you know, the impact of trauma and loss on them and how they feel about the world.
That's interesting because, again, with my children, I recall, so we adopted three children, which was seemed like a good idea at the time, but it was totally madness. You know, it's just like, oh, chaos. And with the eldest and the youngest, there was kind of, I built a quite a good relationship, but with the middle child, she just seemed a bit disinterested in me, and I just started racking my brain what to do. And then it just sort of came to me, just play with her. And so and literally just playing dolls and really, you know, she wanted to play dolls, so I played dolls, and she wanted to do this, so I just did that, and just really tracked her around, and that relationship just grew really naturally and organically. And do you think that what are the sort of the pitfalls do you think or do you see that adopters fall into where in those first, you know, well, not just necessarily in the first few months or weeks, but generally what mistakes are people making or what roads are they going down that they're maybe getting a bit lost on?
I think sometimes it's a difficult balance, but as adopters, we can sometimes defer to the professionals when actually we don't feel comfortable with that strategy, but because the professionals are giving it to us, sometimes we're thinking, well, they must be right. Yeah. And actually to have a bit more confidence in our own parenting and our own understanding of our own children, and going with what we think is the right, obviously informed and also learning all the time, seeking out information. Mm-hmm. I think those are key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would add to that, Al, your example is really good, because I think one of the pitfalls is overcomplicating things. So thinking, you know, you could be like then picking up books that, oh, this could be middle child syndrome, and I need to be kind of doing this and that. You know, and actually, it's just stripping it back. So, you know, why don't I just start with play? Play is, you know, for most children, it's like a very natural form of communication. So, you know, let's start there, you know, and yeah. That's what we're talking about in our course, about how play is so good for building relationships, you know, and it is just getting down, you know, to their level sometimes and playing with the things that they enjoy and kind of going with the flow, you know, is really powerful for like forming and sustaining relationships. So, yeah, keeping it simple, I think, is something that is hard to do. I think also because of like what Yoni says, because of the professionals are saying, try this, you know, but I think as to, you know, as a biological parent, I'd say that's like a pitfall too. It's not trusting your own instincts as a parent sometimes, and always Googling things or reading, you know, like the, how do I do potty training? How am I going to get them to be better? You know, we all kind of fall into those kind of pitfalls of it. But I think, you know, in this circumstance where there's so many other professionals involved as well, it's hard to kind of just trust yourself and create your own parenting journey.
That makes sense as well.
In early stages.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say early stages. Adopters can feel under such scrutiny, can't they? Particularly prior to the adoption order. It's very stressful.
Just rewinding back there, Keely, you mentioned simple. We're going to just take a minute and talk to Al, because he's quite simple. Al, what's happening on the 26th of November?
Okay, so this is an ad break, and I should maybe put music over. I'm gonna put music over it, like the Paul and Dean music. This week's webcast is sponsored by
Bodo's Training.
I don't know. Bodo's Training, ourselves. So on the 26th of of November, we're going to do our annual online conference, which we're going to be focusing in on the impact of adoption and early adversity on identity in children who are growing up adopted. So we've got two adopted adults. We've got Shania Ives, we've got David Benjamin, who are both trained psychotherapists. They're going to talk about their experience, their insight, their perspective. She probably wants to be a professor. Let's just call her professor. Let's just roll into that. You know, what could possibly go wrong? So we've got Professor the good Julie Young. just madness. I can feel the libel cases coming towards us. Who is going to talk about contact and how that can potentially support identity. And we've also got Vicky McEwen, and we've got you, and we've got me. And we're going to be talking about identity. And it's £15. You can go on to noborderstraining.org.
Oh, well done. Congratulations. High five.
Yeah. Throw another peanut into my mouth. and you can literally go on there and you can sign up. It's £15. It's all available afterwards online, either as video and audio or just audio only, and you can come along and we'll send the links to you, so please come on to that. So that was the advert.
On the Facebook Live video that you did at the weekend, you insulted the whole of the East Anglian region by calling it the University of Norwich. It's the University of East Anglia. Just apologising to anybody who may have spotted that little faux pas.
Look, all publicity is good publicity.
Yeah, I'm surprised we haven't had complaints. Anyway, thank you for that, Al.
Sorry. And then, so moving quickly on, can I ask a question then in relation to Yoni and Keely? And do you think that the system we've got sort of maybe overcomplicates, in the sense that because we're constantly telling people that this is going to be difficult, which is right because it potentially is, do you think that then your message is in conflict with that to try and simple things down? Do you think that we're setting people up to fail potentially, or setting up people for heartache and confusion?
I think that there is I think that professionals' anxieties can be overlaid onto your family, that sometimes the professionals want certainty, and they're in our relationships, and I speak as a professional, that then is difficult to create in a family dynamic. I think it is overcomplicated. I think sometimes what we forget is the power of hugs, of positive time with adults, of, you know, going out, being in the environment. I think something that I had no understanding of until I started to work with Keely was the enormous, disproportionate almost power of play, both with children in all stages of their development, and also with the relationships that they build with the adults around them, because it is the way that we've been sort of preconditioned to learn, and so it's much more powerful than any other way of learning. And I don't think, as a professional, I ever saw play as something that I had any point of any part of encouraging, I suppose. You know, it was something that happened because the carers did it, but not that actually it was something that we should be encouraging and facilitating and pushing, you know, to new carers and foster carers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to do therapy play down or play therapy, but do you think even that sort of is overcomplicating play?
Certainly the feedback that I, because some of the carers who've done our course have also done those sorts of courses, and I think that they have felt that perhaps it's more restrictive than, because we're sort of giving people lots of different options, because obviously children want to do certain things and they don't want to do others. And I know a lot of people have asked Keely about children who can't play and don't feel able to play.
And I think, you know, things like therapy, you know, it's assessed first, isn't it, on like what types of play the child would kind of benefit from, and then it's quite structured. I would say sometimes play therapy definitely has its place, because sometimes maybe your children are starting to play things that, you know, are quite concerning, and it feels a bit out of your arena. And again, that goes back to Yoni's point about, you know, parents not having to be, not being expecting to be therapists. So I think, you know, sometimes children will play stuff and it's like, oof, this feels a bit out of my depth, and this just feels like this needs to kind of be worked through with a therapist. But I think there's a lot that can be done just in the parent-child relationship that's just about child-led play, that's just being playful, you know, that's bringing those elements of play into each day, you know, that can have a massive impact without the need for therapy or play therapy, though they do have their place as well. So.
What about the age of, like, children, young people? I mean, is there a kind of, because it's always kind of struck me that some of these things are kind of within an age bracket. I know play therapy, you know, it's kind of, he's 11, 12, probably outside of the boundaries of, you know, where we'd go. I mean, is this kind of stuff that you're talking about, is it age limited, or can it, you know, can you be doing it at the age 14, 13?
I think it depends very much on the child, you know, because I've certainly worked in play therapy with, like, children in residential care who are 15, but emotionally they're about 3. You know, so then sometimes, you know, they've maybe lost those opportunities to play early on, and they really, and that lack really shows in their social and emotional development. So, you know, it can be, you know, that play can still be appropriate for, you know, adolescents as well. But I think sometimes, even if it's not play, as we know, you know, with like dolls or role playing, there's still other ways we can connect playfully with our adolescents as well. You know, that still help to kind of develop relationship. And you want to kind of always just keep a bit of a playful element in your relationship, you know, even when the adolescents, you know, and like, you know, you know nothing, and it's all about the friends, you know, play and just being playful like that can just help to kind of keep the connection with them.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about a piece of work I did when, because I, my day job is as a manager in leaving care teams, and we did a piece of work with young people doing artwork and producing the most amazing drawings, and working with music. And so it's just about linking into whatever that young person is interested in. And I think we take play as being the very broadest spectrum of activities that that can be enjoyed together as a family or as a parent and child.
Do you think that, because you were sort of mentioning age appropriate, and I recall, again, I'm sure my daughter won't mind me saying, but one of the things we noticed was when we were playing dolls until she was about 6, and she started to kind of take this game in a really peculiar way. So what she started to do was she would always take a doll, she'd put them in prams, and she'd cover them over, like put blankets over their face. And a game always involved someone else looking after the baby. And we tried all kinds of ways, but that was kind of, she was hardwired. And we sort of hypothesized about her own experience, about what she'd seen, about what had happened to her. And do you think that, again, we can then, what do we just lean into that and just kind of let children take it where it goes? Or is there a point where we need to, sometimes if things get, you know, because sometimes that could lead into conversations that are perhaps where we do feel out of our depth. What do we do?
I think it maybe also kind of, you know, I would kind of gaze at, if you're kind of thinking, can I deal with this myself, or does this need a professional? I'd be kind of thinking about, is this causing my child distress? You know, and does it feel like, you know, it's really obsessing them to play this? Or like you say, it might lead to difficult conversations. But I think where a starting point is just to reflect, gosh, I notice, you know, that these dollies are always being covered up, and these dollies, you know, are really looking for someone to take care of them. And sometimes just that kind of, just that noticing and kind of voicing it can be enough. For the child, I mean, really, that's a lot of kind of what play therapy is actually about. It's about allowing that child to feel heard and seen. The skill of the play therapist is to try and kind of work out what the child is trying to say through the play. You know, but you can use some of those skills yourself by just acknowledging what you kind of say or what's being said. You know, that can mean an awful lot to the child. It's like any of us, really, when we feel like, you know, we've spoken about something that's obsessed us, or, you know, even excited us, when someone replies back and we feel heard, it means a lot to us. And same for children.
And I think it's particularly, it creates that safe space where a child can feel like they can express themselves in a way that's different than sort of more run-of-the-mill day-to-day life when everyone's sort of dashing around trying to get out to school and work, and or even in schools where, you know, the child's whole day is plotted out for them. So it gives them that little space where they can, you know, we teach about creating a play box which contains things that are special, that are used just in that relationship and are chosen by the parent and the child. And it's just, I think it's just very powerful having that special space. And it's quite validating for children.
Yeah. If it's okay, Yoni, can I ask you a little bit about contemporary adoption? Because I think that we see, we've just had a National Adoption Week a couple of weeks ago. And the conversations, you know, every year they provoke lots of conversations within the adoption community. Who, Adoption Week's not really about us who've kind of passed through the veil. It's about people who are trying to pull people in. Do you have any sort of thoughts in relation to adoption? And because this year's focus was on sort of difference, and part of that difference was in relation to ethnicity. And I know, you know, people are listening, they won't necessarily see that you are, you know, a woman of color. So you know, that you may have a perspective on some of that systemic stuff.
Yeah, I have. And I've also sort of been involved in adoption recruitment as a manager as well previously. And I think it's so important that we have a diverse range of people being successful through adoption. And I've sat on panels for quite a long time, and sometimes you know that a certain panel is expecting a certain kind of family, and perhaps if this family is different than what their expectations are, it can be a bit of a challenge. And I'm feel very strongly about it because of my personal experience as well. And there's a lot of discussions in adoptee groups about how hard adoption is, and I absolutely accept that. But I suppose I come from a point of view as well of knowing what happens when children aren't adopted. In terms of long-term foster care or bouncing around residential systems, and it's not about, you know, one person's trauma is more important than another at all. But I think what we need, I think for me personally, adoption was transformational. My birth mother was the third generation of girls in her family to be brought up in residential care. And so that was where I was probably leading had adoption not been the thing that sort of circuit broke. Yeah. For me. But that's not to say it was easy in all situations. It wasn't, because my parents were white and were originally my foster carers, and then I stayed with them. But I think they didn't really fully understand the implications of having a black child, although they did think about it. So the first black person I met, I think, was I was 18. it was down south, and that. So I had I I had a lot of struggles in terms of finding my own identity. But what I've been, I produced another course which is around anti-racist adoption for people who are perhaps considering taking on transracial adopted children, and what I think they need to be thinking about. And in the research, I found out that and obviously a lot of the data is from America, because sadly we don't record as comprehensively, but that Black adopters in the States would need to adopt at four times the rate of white adopters to be able to match to the Black children waiting. And so I think it's really important that we don't have a two-tier system, which is what we do at the moment, that Black children, particularly Black boys, if they're Black boys with disabilities, then I think it was 36 months, I think, they have to wait to be adopted. And that's just, you know, that's just wrong. So we need to get better at being inclusive and really being inclusive, because I know that there are Black adopters who've gone through the system who didn't feel like their needs were met.
Yeah. Do you think that that's something that's being addressed? I mean, I guess you can reflect on your own experience and the experience of your parents. But one of the things I often think is that very few people come forward specifically to adopt a child of a different race or ethnicity. So often it's kind of a last minute, all right, then these children sort of fit. And so is the assessment as thorough as it perhaps should be? You know, you're on panel, so what do you think?
I don't think social workers necessarily know the right questions to ask. So it's like they might have a list of, well, have you got some the right kind of books, and are you going to take them to a film once in a while? But I think that the really fundamental questions aren't always the ones that social workers know how to ask. And I think there's a reticence to talk about it. I think it's good that we're talking about race much more than we used to pre-lockdown and pre-Black Lives Matters. People are starting to think it through a bit more. And but I think it's so important that people go in with their eyes open, and also that they recognise the biases that they will have inherited. And one of the things that I say in the training that I do is that I assessed my own unconscious bias, and I know how I've got an unconscious bias towards white communities, and I know that's because of all the things that we've been exposed to. But until you know what it is, you can't then consciously defeat those feelings or challenge them or learn more. And so you're sort of doomed to replicate it in your parenting.
Yeah. It feels like an issue that we're talking about, but I don't think there's any sense of, we haven't got very far down that conversation.
No, I think it's one of those things that we know it's a problem, but we're not necessarily sure where the directions to go in order to resolve it. I think adoption, you know, perhaps the centralizing of adoption agencies will help, but perhaps it won't. I don't necessarily think it always will, because then you go to the sort of the common families, or you might be better at recruiting certain families over others.
I mean, in some ways, because we know there's a bit of geography in that as well, isn't there? You know, I mean, let's be honest about it. You know, there's some areas where it is, dare I say, middle class white kind of people that are coming forward. So, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's kind of the children you've got. And then, you know, I think back to 2007 when, you know, we were looking through various, because then there was no internet. I feel old saying that. So it was all through those kind of family finding kind of magazines and newspapers, and you know, it was very much kind of well, for us anyway, you know, as same-sex couple, we were kind of steered into thinking about it differently, and kind of whether we could, you know, have a children placed with us who were of different kind of ethnicities and backgrounds. And in some ways, at the time, it felt like, oh, yeah, we should look at that. But actually, I'm not convinced now that that was probably the best approach. However, I can see why it would be kind of thought through. And, you know, I know, Al, you've got experience of that as well. But just for me, if I think back to where we were living as an example, you know, the fact that we had they had a same-sex couple who were adopted in that kind of place, you know, that would, I think that would have been enough for them. I think that anything else would have blown their heads, kind of thing. And how fair that would have been on children, I'm just not sure. So it is such a kind of tricky one to traverse, isn't it, for everybody, really?
Mm. I know I live in a rural county, Northumberland, and, you know, we're something like 98% white. And I think the biggest ethnic minority is Chinese. And, you know, so my experience of being a transracial adopter is, to be honest, my social work assessment, you know, assessment as adopted parents, was just really, on reflection, just didn't cut the mustard. There wasn't the skill set in the social work workforce because it reflected this rural community. Mm. You know, we'll listen to Bob Marley and eat plantain and everything will be fine.
Yeah. And I think that's the difficulty. And if you're not encouraged to think about the implications long term, then and I think this is the problem with the assessment quite a lot, is that it's about getting you through panel. Mm. It's not necessarily giving you the tools to think about what you're going to need post panel. And then there's this lull, and then suddenly you've got a child, and then you have to sort of backpedal almost. But I don't think we give our adopters, particularly those caring for children transracially, enough understanding of how to deal with racism, how to call it out, how to prepare your child for experiencing racism, because the reality is they will. And so, you know, I experienced racist bullying throughout my childhood, throughout particularly secondary school, not so much in primary school. But my parents didn't know how to deal with it, didn't know how to deal with it in school. And so it became, well, you've got to, you know, you're a sensible girl, you've got to rise above it. And so when on the one occasion that I didn't, that's when I got into trouble. And so that make, you know, if they can't talk about it, then it makes it the child's problem and not something that they're reacting to that is external.
It's a little bit short-sighted. This in some ways, you know, it's like thinking, well, I'm going to adopt a four-year-old and they're going to be four forever, and not realizing that they're going to get to 18 and 21. I'm not comparing that. I'm just saying it's kind of quite similar in that respect, because you're not kind of thinking, this might happen, this will happen, etc. And preparing yourself for it.
And that and there's expertise that's needed. I mean, I work with foster carers in North London, and, you know, I've got foster carers who are black, and they foster black young children, and they understand the world that those young people will grow up in a way that I just can't. Mm. And they are able to negotiate and sort of think about things that were just not on my radar, because it's just, you know, I mean, they are on my radar now because I've been taught. But before that, you think, all right, I hadn't even thought that maybe, you know, that, you know, how you respond to a police officer, because my experience is that, you know, as a white man, everything's tickety-boo. So, and it's that nuanced conversation that adopters need to be kind of... And I think I heard someone speak their experience. They were a transracial adoptee. And they were saying, you know, that even thinking about how this changes your family, a dynamic about how you, when you go out places, where how you... You know, how the whole community responds to you as a family is altered. Are you ready for that?
Definitely. And some of the transracial adoption groups, particularly, I mean, not saying it's not an issue in this in the UK, but some they talk about the American experience of, you know, going and some family members just absolutely having to be cut out because they're so toxic, because they can't be around the children that they've adopted because of the really fundamental racist response that they get. So there's a lot to take. There's a lot to think through, and you don't want to be doing that while you've got a child.
Maybe need to do that beforehand.
You do. You want to be proactive. That's the right question. Anywho, we didn't bring you on. We've kind of sort of hoodwinked you coming on here to talk about this. So, can you tell us about the event, which is free, which that sounds like a really great taster session and an opportunity to kind of get to find out more? Tell us about what you're doing, when you're doing it, and how people will access that.
Johnny, do you want to start?
We're doing a free webinar, and it's five ways to increase attachment with your adoptive child. And it's really, hopefully you'll find, you know, people who come at it will find it fun, it's informative, and it's down to earth, which is pretty much what we both are. Shall I pass you on to Kid?
I love that description, Johnny. That reminds me of a program years ago. They used to have celebrities and they would choose five, was it Star Search, and they choose five different words to describe themselves. So we're fun, grounded, and informative. Yeah, and I think this course, like Johnny says, you know, it's just a webinar, so you know, we're quite easygoing. We're mindful that like sometimes people are doing this late at night after a full day of work and parenting, so we're keeping it light. But the information that we're giving is going to be really useful, just to really help you start to think about maybe there's different ways you can approach your relationship with your child. And if you're kind of, you know, maybe you're a prospective adopter, it can be useful to kind of help you kind of plan ahead. Or maybe you're with your child just now and you may be scratching your head and like, what is it that I can do? You know there'll be something for everybody there, you know. And this really just leads on, we'll talk about it more on the webinar, but a relationship-based play course that Johnny and I deliver that's going much more into depth about how to use play to build a relationship. But the webinar on the 25th,
next Thursday,
7:30, we'll just do like a really good introduction to that.
Smashing. And how do people we'll put the links, but tell us what the links are, what you called,
what
you're doing
Thursday,
what
just,
banner,
you know, before
it's 7:30 on Thursday.
I was just a bit panicked by anybody who might be coming to the conference next day, they might be a bit bleary eyed, you know.
And if they register and they can't come live, then we will be sending out the recording as well.
That's what we like to hear.
Quality, quality.
The link, I'll just tell you what the link is. It's tinyurl.com/5xattachment. So hopefully that's reasonably memorable, but appreciate you putting the link on the information.
We'll put links to everything you're doing as well, because you've got your Facebook page, you've got your website, you've got everything. So we'll put all the links in there, and we'll put this podcast out tomorrow. But it's been lovely to speak to you, and really wish you well, because I think any resources that are really practical and accessible for families is just great. So smashing. Well done.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Love to meet you. Thanks.